Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network. Are you worried about democracy? I have to confess, I am a bit worried about democracy. That's why I listen to a wonderful podcast called Democracy Works. It's run by the fabulous people at the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State University. The podcast aims to rise above partisan politics and the daily news grind to take a broader look at issues impacting democracy. These are things we cannot ignore. You can go to www.democracyworkspodcast.com and subscribe in all kinds of ways, or you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and many other places. We really love this podcast at the NBN, and so much so that we are going to provide you with a little taste of what you can get at Democracy Works. I hope you enjoy the following episode.
From the McCourtney Institute for Democracy and the studios of WPSU on the campus of Penn State University, I'm Michael Berkman.
And I'm Chris Beam, and this is Democracy Works.
Chris, we have a really special guest today. We always have special guests.
Always.
But today we mean it.
No, we always mean it.
Yeah,
we but this is a special guest, and we're lucky to have him.
Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan is a social psychologist. He holds the Thomas Cooley Professor of Ethical Leadership in the Stern Business School at NYU. But I know what strikes me about so much of Jonathan's work is how interdisciplinary it is. I mean, he's a social psychologist, but he also informs political science. And
he teaches at the business school.
He teaches in the business school, mm-hmm. and just all kinds of things brought together, all kinds of strands of thought brought together by Jonathan's work. He's looking at the importance of polarization. And for him, it's the social psychological roots of polarization about how tribal people are by nature.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, what's become different about American politics, and I think he has a nice understanding of this trend in politics, is that people have really sorted themselves out across the parties in such a way that Democrats and Republicans are increasingly unlike one another, both in the kinds of values that they bring to their approaches to politics and other things in terms of where they live, in terms of their demographics. I mean, we've talked about this in various ways.
And in terms of how they're informed, how they understand the world,
right.
How they understand
the
economics,
general,
politics.
The general big sort.
But the point is that our objective here in this episode,
right, is to see what he has to say about democracy.
Right,
not
is to tie those
education.
Into democracy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to see, you know, to reflect on... You know, we talk a lot on this podcast about how democracy it takes work, right? And it's unnatural. And it's and Jenna once asked me, you know, you never say why you think it's unnatural. And so I think that is where Jonathan's insight is most relevant and helpful, is because he just kind of says, here's why, right?
Yes, yeah. And he'll talk about that with Jenna, I'm mm-hmm. sure. But, you know, this idea that it's in our nature to be tribal.
Mm-hmm.
The parties have sorted in such a way that we're in kind of almost like tribes, although I don't know that he would use the word tribe, but he might. And so much of what he concerns him, he sees there. But I also think he's concerned about, you know, how we're raising our next generation mm-hmm. of democratic mm-hmm. citizens.
Right. I think that's right. And how things that you don't necessarily see as connected are indispensable, right? Literally, I mean, that if you're going to be a democratic citizen, you have to learn how to work through problems. You have to learn how to hear things you don't want to hear, things that you disagree with, and how to disagree without being disagreeable, without getting into fights. And he would argue that we haven't done a very good job. Our generation hasn't done a good job of teaching, you know, this generation of incoming college students how to do those things. And as a result, democracy is worse off.
Yes, because we didn't follow the directive that I know my mother had, mm-hmm. which was get out of the house
right.
and don't come back until dinner time.
Right, right, right. When the streetlights come on, that's when you have to come in. I don't know any kid our age that didn't hear that.
Right, right. And you know, he sees that. I don't think anybody would argue with that. Anybody that's, you know, involved in raising kids now and – you know, it's like you can't just send them out to play. There's nobody out on the street playing. They're all at soccer practice.
Right.
And he sees that, you know, he's one who sort of takes that to its implications.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What does it mean if we're not just sending kids out to learn how to play by themselves?
All right.
Yeah. Let's bring him on, and I'm sure everybody will find him as interesting as we do.
Yeah.
This is Jenna Spinelli here today with Jonathan Haidt. John, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Jenna.
So, John, you have written, and we say on this podcast all the time that democracy is hard work. It's not natural. It's not easy. And I think you are perhaps uniquely qualified to help us understand why that is.
Okay. Well, let's give it a try.
Yeah.
So I'm a social psychologist, and I study morality. And I always try to put everything in both an evolutionary context and a cultural context. You know, there is a human nature. We're products of evolution. But one of the great innovations is that we're actually pretty flexible, and humans live in all kinds of ways around the world. And so the way I like to approach the problem is to say, well, how do humans tend to live politically? And as far as I can tell, there are two main ways. There are two ways that are really, really stable and widely found. And so one is egalitarian hunter-gatherers. This is the way all of our ancestors lived for hundreds of thousands or millions of years, depending on how you count it. And before they get settled, before there's agriculture, this is the way all societies are. And then once you take up agriculture, you get hierarchy, and pretty quickly you get something like feudalism, and it emerges on multiple continents, and you know it's really clear in Japan. And so these two ways of living really fit with our psychology. And then there are a bunch of other ways that have been tried, you know, communism, communes, democracy, and these ways tend to be very short-lived. They tend to be very unstable. Plato said it's the second worst form of government because it always descends into tyranny because the people get carried away by passions. So democracy is not really such a great thing. What is great is that the people can kick out the government if they don't like it. The people have to have the ability to reject the government if they don't like it. And that was what our founding fathers were really committed to. And so they gave us a republic with democratic features. And, you know, look, I'm not a political scientist or an historian. I'm sure I'm getting some details wrong here. But the big picture is that in the 20th century, we developed this obsession with democracy. And I think it's because we fought a war to defend democracy in World War I. And then we did it again in World War II. And we all got kind of fooled into thinking that democracy is the greatest thing in the world. And then in the 1990s, when the Soviet Union collapses, it was clear that democracy won and there is no alternative. And it's the end of history in every country as it develops is going to become a free market liberal democracy just like us. And we were wrong. We were fooled. Democracy is a lot harder, a lot less stable. And now it's clear we took it for granted, and it's a lot harder than we thought.
Right. So are there things about the way we're wired as people that make it so hard or so kind of difficult to carry out in practice?
Yes. So the founding fathers, in addition to being great historians, I mean, for their era and with the limited books that they could get, they really tried hard to study the lessons of history. They were also really good psychologists. And again, with no research, just reflecting on human nature, as was actually the custom in the 18th century, the Age of Enlightenment. I mean, that was really the beginning of good psychology. And this is where my own work comes in. The reason I got into this aspect of political theory is because I study moral psychology. And my research basically led me to the view of David Hume, that reason is and ought only to be the slave of the passions and can never pretend to any other office than to serve and obey them. So Hume was basically disagreeing with the long rationalist tradition in philosophy, saying all you people who think like, oh, humans are such great reasoners and we're rational and that's our God-given ability, you're just completely wrong. Have you ever looked at a person? Do you relate to any people? We're not like that. And the founding fathers knew that. And so that's why you don't want to have something that's too democratic, because especially when there are hard times, somebody's going to come along and tell you the reason for our troubles is them. They're the reason. And it's really easy to rally people to hate them and then attack them and kill them. So the founding fathers knew that. And as again, I'm not an historian, but it seems as though a lot of the reforms in the progressive era made America more democratic. Now, they were responding to all kinds of corruptions and problems. I'm not saying that the progressive era was wrong. I'm just saying we got a lot more democratic in our reforms in the 20th century, and after Watergate as well, various reforms. And some of them may have kind of backfired, and many people will look at the 2016 election and see, in many ways, the fulfillment of the Founding Fathers' worst nightmares, as they expressed in the Federalist Papers.
Right. But, you know, even though you kind of started to touch a little bit on this kind of idea of, you know, we're not as rational as we think. And even though we all kind of understand that democracy is so hard, it doesn't really stop us from trying to practice it. Right. We vote and we support the free press and we go out and organize or demonstrate, some of us. So what motivates people to do those types of things, even in the face of knowing that it is hard and it is, you know, all the things we were talking about earlier?
So, you know, the Founding Fathers thought that democracy, so, you know, we talk about the American experiment, and what it really was, as I understand it, was an experiment in self-government. Because in 1776, there were not a lot of examples, or I think there were none, of people self-governing. It was always either a monarch of some sort or a dictator. And I believe they wrote a lot about the need for virtues. So you have to, they definitely wrote about the need for education. They believed a lot in public education. You have to educate people for democracy. You have to cultivate virtues for democracy, self-control, willingness to follow rules, abide by procedures, accept defeat, compromise. So there are virtues, and then there are institutions. Respect for the courts, rule of law. And so if you have all these things, then it's kind of like a playing field on which people can pursue their interests, what they call the pursuit of happiness. Happiness didn't mean joy. It meant the pursuit of a well-ordered life in which you are successful and you like your life. It was your condition, your state is what happiness meant. And so people Americans have long been known for being individualists. And de Tocqueville noted how we individualists come together very quickly and easily to solve problems. That was what he noted was really unique about us. So we've always been a democratic people in that sense, ready to take things into our own hands, solve problems. And America in the 20th century, we certainly see many cases of activism that were like that and that worked. Of course, taking things into your own hands can also lead to riots and violence. But we're not a subjugated people. We're a free people. And, our political behavior shows that.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, thinking specifically about the way that we've organized ourselves into political parties here in the U.S., your book, The Righteous Mind, does a great job of going through several moral foundations that separate, you know, what conservatives value versus what, mm-hmm. what liberals value. Can you kind of walk us through what those are and how the parties differ in that way?
Sure. So the Founding Fathers didn't want political parties, but of course, as soon as the Constitution was proposed, there was one saying yes and one saying no. The worst number of political parties to have in a country is one. But the second worst number is two, because we evolved for tribal warfare. We evolved to do us versus them. And research shows that if you simply have three combatants, then the hatred of each for the other is much less. And my colleagues and I came up with a theory called moral foundations theory, based in part on the work of Richard Schwader, an anthropologist at the University of Chicago. And what we did is we said, okay, what are the taste buds of the moral sense? What are the features, the intuitions that you find all over the world? It doesn't have to be in every single society, but what are the very, very common features that you see? And so the list we came up with by looking at anthropology and evolution, because for each one we said there has to be an off-the-shelf evolutionary theory. We're not going to do armchair evolution and make stuff up. And so the five really clear matches were, the first is care versus harm. And that comes right out of the attachment system. We're mammals. We care for our young. We're sensitive to harm. The second is fairness versus cheating. And there's work on reciprocal altruism. And every society has reciprocity. And the third is loyalty versus betrayal. We do coalitional psychology. The fourth is authority versus subversion. We're primates. We have deep, deep hierarchical psychology. We show deference the same way that other primates do. And the last of the original five is called sanctity versus degradation. This is something no other animal has, but we have this emotion of disgust. We see contamination. If A touches B and B touches C, then C takes on the properties of A. We have all kinds of magical beliefs. And you see this in religious practice, sacred objects. A lot of moral regulation is about who can touch what, when, and with what purification rituals beforehand. So those are the five original ones. There's a bunch more. We talk now about liberty versus oppression. I think property or possession is one. So there's, I don't believe in parsimony. I don't believe that evolution gave a damn about parsimony or simplicity. And so the mind is just a lot of stuff in it. What we found empirically is that people on the left in the United States, but we find this in most other countries we look at too, they tend to build their moral world on care, the care foundation, and then a version of fairness, which emphasizes equality. Those are the two main ones. People on the right, they have those concerns. They certainly love their children and their dogs with, you know, their care, attachment. But their political theories, their social understandings are not based primarily on a sense of compassion for suffering. They're based more on a sense of fairness as just desert, as proportionality. Do the crime, do the time. And then conservatives also build a lot more on group loyalty, all the way out to nationalism, respect for authority, you know, God and country, respect your parents, and a sense of sanctity or purity, especially the social conservatives, the Christian conservatives. Libertarians are different. Libertarians are actually low on everything except for liberty. They really, really value liberty. And so what we got, beginning once Johnson signs the Civil Rights Act, and that sets in motion a set of tectonic changes whereby the Southern conservative Democrats begin shifting over to the Republican Party, just as President Johnson had predicted. And then the liberal Republicans start getting either primaried or pushed out. So only by the 1990s do we get a perfect sorting where we have two parties, and anyone who's psychologically disposed to leftism or progressivism is now a Democrat, and anyone psychologically predisposed to conservatism or traditionalism or stability or order is now a Republican. And that means that the people on the other side really are odious. They really are different from us. It's not just that they have different material interests where we could compromise. No, no, no. Those people, and you can go through the list of the virtues that they don't have that your side does. And that's part of the reason why, when you look at cross-partisan hatred, the degree to which people on both sides hate each other, it was pretty low in the 70s. I mean, the graphs from ANES, the American National Election Survey, show not much hatred. I mean, we didn't like people on the other side, but we didn't hate them. And we didn't mind so much if our children married someone from the other party. And since then, the hatred for the other side and the unwillingness to have your kids marry the other side has just gone up and up and up, and especially in the 2000s. And that's where we are today.
Right. And so have those moral foundations stayed the same, or you can kind of, where do they stand now in 2019, you know, Donald Trump as president?
Yeah. So the moral foundations never change. That's the whole metaphor, is that they're foundations. But a political party, a political worldview is like a building, but that's too static a metaphor because, you know, even over the course of every 4 years, the particular building changes. And so, you know, what the left was in the early 80s, in the 70s and 80s, it was really drifting more towards sort of European leftism. And then Bill Clinton pulls it back and gives us a more centrist version, which is more pro-business. You know, the Republicans, by many measures, began to radicalize, move further right in the 90s and 2000s. And now it's pretty clear it's the Democrats' turn. Now they are building one that's much more sympathetic to socialism. So each side, if you think about it, as each side constructs a moral matrix, and I mean matrix like the movie The Matrix, which Gibson defined as a consensual hallucination. A moral or political order is a consensual hallucination. We hallucinate it together. We pretend that it's real. It becomes real. We live in it and we get angry within it.
Right.
And those are constantly in flux.
Right. And now, of course, we tweet about it and it all, you know, it's on cable news 24 hours a day, yeah. those kind of things. Mm-hmm. This actually ties to another kind of metaphor from your previous work of the elephant and the rider. So as I was going through The Righteous Mind, I wrote that 2019, it's like the elephants on steroids.
That's right. No, that's right.
Yeah. So can you explain to us what that mm-hmm. Metaphor means and how it relates to how we, mm-hmm. we view each other in a democracy?
Sure. Politics is always a game of it's driven by emotions and passions and interests. And then the job of the rider's not really in charge. The rider is really more of, as Hume said, a servant or a press secretary is a good mm-hmm. metaphor of the emotions. You see this in politics. You know, we can justify anything our side wants, and then next year, you know, something flips and we justify the opposite, as we saw with the healthcare debate and all sorts of things. So if you think about it as this delicate balance between what we can articulate with our reasons and what we really want with our tribal emotions, and then you think of a healthy political order in which there are some restraints on what you can say, and there are social restraints where you can't just lie and you can't say things that are just obviously untrue. They have to be at least justifiable. And so you imagine a system in some sort of balance with all that, and you have a stable political order. And then just for fun, why don't we reach into the social network, the basic structure of society, and let's take all the cables connecting individuals to individuals, and let's suddenly change their capacity 100-fold. Let's just make everyone really, really connected instantly to everyone else and able to respond to everyone else right away. And let's do this maybe around 2006, 2007. We'll start it. We'll call it Facebook. And then we'll have a lot of other platforms that do this. And let's also add a lot of video. Let's give everyone a video camera in their pocket, so that everyone gets to take videos of the most outrageous things that people on the other side are doing and saying. And we'll give everyone a way that they can put into this sort of the social stream the most shocking, horrifying, outrage-inducing videos they can come up with. And we'll have a filtration process that only the really best ones are the ones that get sent to millions and millions of people. This can all happen within a few hours, or certainly a day or two is all it takes. What happens to that delicate balance? It goes completely haywire in countries all around the world. And this is the main reason, I think, why it seems as though democracy is in big trouble and things are falling apart. There are a lot of trends. There's globalization, inequality. There are a lot of trends. But the sudden linking of everyone to everyone and with materials that outrage the elephant in the space of about 5 or 10 years, I think, is the reason why things are really going to hell.
Yeah, I mean, which is kind of ironic as you think about it. These tools on their face should be the most democratizing things out there, right? I mean, we've kind of had this discussion on our show before about how they're also on the one hand used to organize people and connect people in all these ways, but as you said, it seems like there has to be some type of restraint or kind of balance there that just doesn't. We've never quite gotten around to that piece of things.
Well, that's right. So a lot of it depends on your view of human nature. And so this is one of the main things. So I started off on the left and I started writing The Righteous Mind in order to help the Democrats win because I couldn't stand it. They had no idea, like Al Gore and John Kerry, they had no idea how to talk about American morality. So I began reading conservative writings in order to understand it. And in the process, I discovered, you know, what John Stuart Mill told us all along, he who knows only his own side of the case knows little of that. You really don't know anything until you know the criticisms of your view and you know whether or not they're valid. And so I learned a lot about conservatism and came to have tremendous respect for the philosophical tradition, not for the Republican Party, but for the conservative philosophical tradition. And so suppose the internet was developed only by people on the left. By people who had no clue about conservative arguments or conservative ideas. You might get something like this. This is from the founder of the Stanford Persuasive Technology Lab. So this is a particular lab at Stanford that taught a generation of people how to create devices and programs that will addict people, that will hook people. So a lot of the architecture of our modern internet was created out of Stanford or the Bay Area. And so here's what the founder of that lab said. If I weren't an optimist about human nature, I would be worried about the future But I am an optimist. I believe that we humans are fundamentally good. Now that persuasive technology is being put into the hands of millions of people, the tools for creating these systems are no longer given only to the highly trained. It's democratic. It's good. Let's connect. Let's empower. I'm paraphrasing here. But the point is, it was created by people who really didn't understand human nature. And had the internet been created by conservatives, they would have said, my God, you know, people are monsters unless they're constrained. We're not just going to connect everyone to everyone. And my God, there's going to be hacking. There's going to be all kinds of exploitation. We've got to build a really defensive internet. We can't just connect everyone. Now, unfortunately, you know, people on the right are more tradition-oriented. They're not as creative or innovative. I'm sure you're going to get a lot of hate mail about this. Each side has its virtues. And I'm really big on the fact that it's when you put left and right together, you get a yin-yang. Each side really has something to contribute.
Sure.
So, yeah, the internet was created by people who didn't understand human nature, and now I think it's wrecking our most valuable political systems.
Right. And on that point of putting left or right together, I see a lot, I hear a lot of calls for restoring civility. I see that hashtag on Twitter all the time. What do you make of that? Is that the right approach given where things are and how we're wired?
It's absolutely the right approach that we need to restore civility, but it's the wrong approach to thinking, hey, let's all just say we should restore civility and let's take a pledge. Let's sign a pledge. You know, because what we really mean by civility is you guys need to be more civil. You guys need to stop doing what you're doing. And so I'm a social psychologist. I don't think we're going to get very far by training riders. I think we're going to get really far by changing the path that the elephant is on. And so anything that rewards call-out culture, anything that gives you prestige for shaming and humiliating others, for forwarding false or even true outrage materials, as long as the structural system, as long as the reward systems, the prestige economy does that, we're all just going to be continuing to choke on outrage. So it's going to take changing the algorithms somehow to reward. So I think the word for 2019 should be nuance. That's my favorite word now. And now that Twitter doubled its character length, whatever, a couple years ago, now it's actually possible, even on Twitter, to sometimes say, I think you're right about X, but I disagree on Y. Like, you can do that in 240 characters now. And so if there was a way to reward nuance and to punish oversimplification or people who are frequent outragers, you know, if you think about it like CO2 pollution, like, you know, we're in a biosphere, and if people are making a lot of smoke, you know, or like in the LA area, they're very sensitive to this, you know, and we're all choking on it. And in the same way, if you have a friend who keeps forwarding outrage articles, they're just putting out smoke and we're all choking on it. And if there was a way to not quite shame them, but somehow make them less prestigious, that would help.
Right. And this ties to some of your work in your latest book, The Coddling of the American Mind. From your work that you've done on Gen Z, what do you think we're likely to see from them moving forward?
The rap on democracies has always been that they tend to be weak, inconsistent, driven by passion. And, you know, this is what Mussolini said about democracies in the 30s, and it wasn't clear in the 30s that democracy was the right way. Well, you know, Xi Jinping is doing a pretty darn good job of supporting Mussolini's critique of democracy. Any developing country that looks at America and looks at China and says, what kind of government do we want? I mean, they'd be crazy to take our form, at least in what they see now. Xi Jinping's authoritarian, we can call it authoritarian capitalism, is delivering the goods, delivering growth, and giving stability. So I think, you know, so if you're growing up now as in America, you're not exactly going to be pro-China. But if someone asks you, is it absolutely essential to live in a democracy? Like, why would you say yes? Mm-hmm. Say maybe, probably. It's pretty good, but not that good.
Right. Or you just don't have that frame of reference. You don't maybe have the historical background as well. You talked a lot about the decline of civics education. And kind of on that point of education, I know you've also written about the relationship between free play and democracy, which that you know people might make readily.
That's right.
So what does that look like in your mind?
Yeah. So I co-wrote this book, The Coddling of the American Mind, with my friend Greg Lukianoff, and we're trying to understand why is it that campus culture changed so quickly between 2014 and 2017. Not everywhere, but at the elite schools, especially in the Northeast. There's a new culture of safetyism in which students who, you know, the millennials who were college students in the early 2000s. The last of them graduated around 2015 or so, 2016. And so there's an enormous rise of self-perceived fragility and a lack of toughness. And people started commenting on how the Gen Z, the kids born in 1996 or later, Gen Z is not able to solve basic problems for themselves. They expect adults to fix things if they're wrong. They're not self-reliant. They do not have the virtues of liberty that the Founding Fathers thought and that de Tocqueville praised in us. Why is this? So in our book, we go into six reasons why this new culture came about so quickly. But the biggest one, the biggest single one, I believe, is that kids in America always were let out at the age of six. I give this talk all over the country. I always ask, and the mode is six. If you were born before 1982, if you're Gen X or older, you were let out in first grade. And you'd go outside and you'd play. And in play groups, there's a lot of research on play. In play, you learn to cooperate. You learn to set rules. You learn what to do when someone seems to have broken the rules. How do we adjudicate this? If some kids are really young, well, how can we incorporate them in play? We'll take it easy on them. So this is how you learn social skills, is play, free play. And it has to be unsupervised. If there's an adult there to settle disputes, you learn nothing. No, wait a second. You learn how to appeal to adults. And so Gen Z is the first generation in American history that was deprived of childhood. We freaked out in the 90s and thought, even though the crime rate was plummeting, and actually the crime wave ended in the 90s, Americans began to think, because we were frightened out of our minds by the media, that if we ever take our eyes off our kids outside, they will be abducted. And so in the 90s, we stopped letting kids out. And by the early 2000s, nobody had seen a child outside unsupervised in 10 years. And so in the early 2000s, you start hearing about adults who are arrested because their kid was caught playing outside. And so since we have a whole generation beginning with kids born in 1996 who didn't get to practice, they didn't get thousands and thousands of hours of practice of free play in mixed age groups where they had to set the rules and resolve disputes, this, we believe, they simply did not learn the skills of democracy. Democracy requires setting rules, enforcing rules, changing rules, compromise, working it out. A self-governing people can solve this, whereas what de Tocqueville was saying was that, well, my God, in France, if there's a problem, it takes an aristocrat to solve it, or the government. And so I think our democracy is in real danger now, but when Gen Z becomes more politically active, you know, so in the 2030s, when they'll be the largest group, let's say, I think our ability to govern ourselves will be much harder.
Yeah, so that runs counter to a lot of what we heard. Typically, people place their hope in Gen Z, I think, thinking about things like the Parkland students and, you know, increased voter turnout among Gen Z. But would you consider those things to be more outliers in terms of the overall?
Overall, I have the opposite view. Mm-hmm. But the Parkland thing, that was the one that was excellent. And the reason why that was excellent was the way the students responded to that is they actually did some research. Gun control is a complicated issue. Simple solutions are going to backfire and not work. They actually did some research. And they came out with a proposal, I think it was 9 points, or I can't remember. But I used to run a gun control group when I was in college. I know a lot about the issue. And I read it, said, my God, they really thought this through. And then they went to Tallahassee, and they protested, and they tried, but they tried to get a law passed. Now, they failed, but they really did research, and then they organized to apply pressure in the right place. That's about the only time I've seen that. So I think a lot of the Gen Z activism is very counterproductive. Activism divorced from research is a bad thing. Activism, it's just we're a bunch of young, angry people, and we're going to demand that you do something which is probably going to backfire. That's a bad thing. So no, I think that, you know, again, I don't blame Gen Z. We did this to them. We deprived them of childhood. But if they all behave like the Parkland students, that'll be great. But that's the only case I know of where they did that.
You know, people who listen to this show are concerned about democracy. They would not have sought out a podcast all about democracy if they weren't. So, what can people do, or you know, what's your advice to concerned small D Democrats out there for how to right the ship, so to speak?
So I think we have to break it up into a couple of levels. So the first thing is we have to give kids back childhood to create more resilient kids. And this isn't, the argument here isn't, oh, if you love democracy. The argument is, oh, if you love your children. I mean, the rates of anxiety and depression are skyrocketing, especially for girls. So there is an urgent national health emergency that we have to stop overprotecting kids. We have to let them develop skills of independence. So that will pay off in about 30 years. If we could start doing that tomorrow, in 30 or 40 years, our democracy would be better. So that's one thing we have to start doing. Secondly, I think we have to educate kids as if democracy was fragile and as if it mattered. And so that means we have to be teaching skills of democratic engagement. And so so I co-founded an organization called letgrow.org with Lenore Skenazy, who wrote Free Range Kids. So anybody who has kids under 16, please go to letgrow.org, and you'll learn all kinds of ways to give your kid back childhood and to encourage your schools, your kids' schools, to raise stronger, healthier kids. Second, in terms of teaching skills of interaction, I think that high school should be teaching politics in a very different way. That is, teachers and social studies teachers in particular tend to be on the left. They either don't teach anything about conservatism, or some of them let their politics intrude. And I think we should be teaching great respect for the long philosophical traditions of left and right, and then teaching skills of democratic discourse.
We're going to end now, as we always do, with our four Mood of the Nation poll questions. So again, this will be kind of like a lightning round, thinking specifically about American politics. What makes you angry?
What makes me angry is, as I said, corruption. Mm-hmm. The fact that people can buy influence. Mm-hmm. Money always speaks, but we have to do everything we can to reduce the volume that it speaks at. Should be a bipartisan thing. We've got to get, this isn't about which team wins. This is about the integrity of the rules of the game.
What makes you proud?
Well, as I said, I just saw Hamilton, and it was the best play I have ever seen. And like, my heart was just bursting. Just to remember how great this country really is and how amazing its founding was, and the miracle that we had those men thinking those thoughts, engaged in the kinds of conflicts that they're engaged in, other than the duels. I wish we didn't have the duels. So that really re-triggered my sense of pride in being an American.
What makes you worry?
What makes me worry is Gen Z. What makes me worry is that, with the best of intentions, we have overprotected kids born after 1996, and therefore we have deprived them of the virtues and skills of democratic self-government.
And then finally, what gives you hope?
My first answer, because you told me before and you might ask me this, and I was thinking nothing gives me hope. But let's be realistic here. So despite my pessimism, I always carry around a little inner Steve Pinker. So Steve Pinker, cognitive psychologist at Harvard, he has a couple of books, The Better Angels of Our Nature and Enlightenment Now, in which he his career now is basically combating people like me who are pessimists. We're friends. I respect him greatly. But, Steve is always reminding us that throughout history, not at every time, but many points in history, people were incredibly pessimistic, yet things have gotten better and better. There are temporary reversals, but they're always temporary. GDP is going up. Education is going up. Health is going up. Almost every good thing. If you care about human experience, human welfare, human rights, the big picture is amazingly good over the last 50 years, and it continues to get better. Nick Kristof writes about this also. He says, each year he says, guess what, guys? Last year was the best year in human history. So even though – and so here's the main thing. When I look at the trends for our democracy, they're mostly down. And if present trends continue, then we will fall apart and we will fail as a nation. But present trends never continue. The worse things get, the more people come in to try to work on them. So one thing we can say for sure is that not all present trends will continue, and many will reverse. So, my feeling is pessimistic, but the rider, the rational part, is at least saying, odds are things will be better 30 years from now than they are today.
Great. Well, that is a great place to leave things. John, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
We've just been sitting here thinking, well, where do we go with that? There is just so much to talk about.
Talked about so much.
Right. And all of it is...
I mean, that is what's so interesting about his work. It goes in so many different directions.
Right.
Able to talk about philosophy, psychology, politics, history, bring things together. And, the modern university is so hyper-specialized that we just don't get a lot of people these days that are able to do that. Well, I mean, there's some scientists we think about as real public intellectuals, but from a social scientist perspective, I have a hard time thinking about anybody quite in Jonathan's league.
I couldn't agree more. The other thing is just, you know, seeing the talk yesterday, just how thirsty people are for that.
You know, I have to say, probably the first of our guests who, when we've asked our four questions to about what are you angry, hopeful, when it came to hope, did not put all his hope in, you know, the next generation of kids. How often have we heard that answer? My hope is in the next generation. My hope is in the future. My hope is in the Parkland kids. And while he did talk quite positively about the Parkland kids, although maybe in a different way than we've talked about them at different times on this show, you know, he's concerned about this generation of college kids. He's teaching on a college campus, and he's concerned.
No, and you know, who knows, right? I mean, it just strikes me as, you know, unlikely that these Gen Z folks are going to prevail against the world, right? They're going to get out they're going to find out that it's not this way, and they're going to have to adjust. So, Michael, what did you think about what Jonathan said about this kind of, you know, the lines that he tells himself not to get too overly depressed and to see this kind of these short-term trends within the context of these longer and more, much more positive trends towards human rights and freedom and health and, you know, people getting fed and things like that.
Right. On the one hand, we're doing better than we ever have.
Right. Humanity.
Yeah. Humanity is doing better than it ever has. I don't know that democracy is necessarily doing better than it ever has these days. And I mean, I'm struck by this idea that Martin Luther King used to talk about, that the arc of justice. The arc of history bends towards justice.
Is long, but bends towards justice.
And of course, Barack Obama, with a campaign of hope, used to rely on that quite a bit as well. But maybe the arc of history bends towards authoritarianism.
Well,
maybe democracy is just a moment, and that democracy, because it is so hard, because it is so unnatural, which is really his argument, essentially. And because we're seeing these models in, for example, China of authoritarian capitalism, where you can have fast economic growth and people's standard of living can increase, but without democracy, that maybe, you know, maybe the arc of history does not bend towards justice, or at least not towards democracy.
You know, I mean, so I think what that the response that requires is to nuance, which is a word he wanted or wants to put forward, the idea of unnaturalness, right? Because while, yeah, there are things about democracy that are unnatural, there is also naturally this desire in the, you know, in the breast of every human being to be free and do what they want, right? And to say, this is what I believe, and I don't want you telling me what to believe. And I don't think that is any less natural than our kind of, like, you know, this kind of respect for authority and things like that. And so it may just be that, you know, I mean, you know, I've actually said this in another context, that democracy is not great, but it's the least worst. And I would continue to, you know, put that forward as an argument that, you know, we have to live together, and we all deserve to have certain prerequisites to how we live, and democracy is the least worst way for us to do that. You know, it's natural and easy for us to look at trends in, you know, 5-10 year increments. Over 50 years, who knows? We just don't know.
Well, good point. And I mean, we'll be doing democracy work in 50 years. We'll be talking about the hard work of democracy, and we could come back.
Somebody else might.
You don't think we'll be here?
No, I don't. But, you know, who knows?
Andy will still be
here. That's right. Somebody will still be here. Somebody will still be keeping up the, you know, picking up the mantle. And, yeah, anyway. So from the Recording Institute for Democracy at Penn State in the studios of WPSU, I'm Chris Beam.
And I'm Michael Berkman.
And this has been Democracy Works. Thanks for listening.
Democracy Works is produced by the McCourtney Institute for Democracy at Penn State and WPSU Penn State. Our hosts are Michael Berkman, Chris Beam, and me, Jenna Spinelli. Andy Grant is our engineer, and Mark Stitzer is our editor. Additional support comes from Emily Reddy, Shireen Stanford, Craig Johnson, and the rest of the team at WPSU. For detailed show notes and discussion questions for each episode, visit our website at democracyworkspodcast.com. And if you like what you heard today, please consider rating or reviewing us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thanks for listening.